Does it feel like a really long time since you booked a plane ticket? Even though 2020 hasn't exactly been the year of travel, some Aussies have booked a lot of tickets only to have them cancelled. There's heaps of young people still stuck overseas who have been trying to get on a plane home for months. We're going to take a look at why it's been so difficult. Hey, I'm Isabella Higgins with UN Hack. Also on the show today, remember when we were all being told we needed to download the COVID Safe app? Well, how successful has that been? And one of Australia's young tech billionaires is chucking himself in the middle of the political energy debate.
Hack.
Well, if we'd known it was going to get to this point, we would have done what we could have done to get home sooner. We definitely would have.
On Triple J.
How many Aussies do you think are still stuck overseas wanting to come home? Well, according to the Foreign Affairs Department, it's about 27,000. Let me know if you or any of your family or friends are one of those who have been trying to make it back. At the moment, Australia is limiting how many people can return to the country each day, but there's now calls to increase that cap to get more people home. In a moment, we'll talk to the opposition leader, Anthony Albanese, about what he wants to see happen. But first, Joe Lauder takes a look at the situation.
We had ties to America. We couldn't just uproot and leave. At that point, we thought the best decision was to stay in America. I didn't think I would ever be pretty much impossible to return to my home country.
This is 29-year-old George Miller. He was in the States with his American girlfriend when the coronavirus pandemic hit. At the time, they made the call to stick together until they could both fly back to Australia.
The whole time, I didn't want to be separated from my partner. And if I went to Australia without her, I could have been trapped there because Australia's not letting anybody out.
But getting home to Australia has been a bureaucratic nightmare, not to mention emotional. To start with, they had to wait for his girlfriend's Australian visa.
I was able to stay in America for 150 days because of a loophole in their coronavirus exemptions, because we were still waiting for a visa for my partner, so we couldn't leave to Australia at that time. But then I ran out of days in America. End of July.
Basically, George had to go to Canada after his US visa ran out and his partner was still waiting on her Australian one. Once their visas were sorted, they booked a flight in June to come home on the 4th of September. But in July, the federal government introduced a cap on the number of people allowed to fly into Australia, 4,000 people per week. And people like George started getting bumped from their flights because airlines that are flying very empty flights are favouring people in business and first class who pay more for their tickets.
I kept calling every day and they said, within 48 hours of your flight departure, if you haven't been bumped, you're on the flight, guaranteed. We're ready. Packed up, ready to go, and then 26 hours before our departure, we just get an email at like midnight that just said our flight's been cancelled.
So they were rescheduled onto the next available flight in December.
The night before you're flying, you just actually start to breathe and relax like you're actually going to be coming home, and then you just get heartbroken and then it's indescribable how bad it is.
They've now booked a second lot of tickets to Australia with a different airline to see if they can get home sooner.
It's been a nightmare trying to get home.
From my experience and experience of others, you don't know if you're getting on that flight until they hand you that boarding ticket.
Daniel's also been in the same cycle of flight cancellations and stress. He's been living and working in Canada, but his visa's up in November and he wants to come home. He booked a flight home for September and quit his two jobs and moved out of his accommodation and got ready to catch a plane home.
3 weeks out from that, you know, I'm just constantly stressing and anxious. I think I had to reschedule the flight a few times. 2 days before the flight, I get an email saying that my flight's been cancelled. So I immediately call up to reschedule that flight. And the nearest they could give me was 25th of October. I mean, just on flights alone, I've probably spent about $5,500 just on accommodation since coming to Vancouver. I've probably spent just short of $1,000. And then on top of that, I got quarantine fees.
This situation is playing out for thousands of Australians stuck abroad. Like Daniel and George, these are people who had jobs, homes, friends and lives overseas. And they thought the best option was to wait out the pandemic where they were. According to the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, 27,000 people are now trying to come home.
Currently, around 36,000 people are registered with the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade as being overseas. And of those, more than 27,000 have expressed a wish to return.
The federal government says the cap is there to ease the pressure on the states and their hotel quarantine systems.
If we can lift the hotel quarantine numbers, then we can increase the number of Australians that can return home. We're working very constructively with the states to that effect.
Today, the Deputy Prime Minister, Michael McCormack, said they've asked the states and territories to increase their hotel quarantine system so they can increase the cap to let an extra 2,000 people in a week.
I've written to each and every one of the premiers and chief ministers to tell them that the caps for international flights based on quarantine levels and based on our reasonable record in recent days and weeks as far as the number of cases of COVID, we want to make sure that we can get more Australians home.
Hack Triple J.
Joe Lauder reporting there. And on the text line, cousins are stuck in the UK. Flights cancelled to get home would cost $115,000 for a family of five. Lucky they have family there. Now, the government is asking the states to accept an extra 2,000 international arrivals a week. The federal opposition have said there are more national resources that could be used to accommodate return travellers. We're joined now by Anthony Albanese to discuss what Labor wants to see happen here. Mr. Albanese, thanks for joining us on Hack today.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you too. Now, the government has said they very much want to have states to continue to manage quarantine practices as they've done throughout this pandemic. But you'd like to see more federal facilities like army barracks or detention centres open for quarantine?
Look, there's a range of facilities available. Early on in the pandemic, the facility outside of Darwin was used. It can house 3,000 people. We had today the West Australian Premier, Mark McGowan, say that Rottnest Island could be made available. What we need here is actually national leadership. There's no shortage of planes that are available, be they commercial aircraft or be they the Royal Australian Air Force VIP fleet that could be made available easily, given that it's not being used that much by the Prime Minister, the Governor-General or other ministers. And there's no shortage of hotel accommodation as well, as we know, because international visitors aren't coming. All that's required here is a bit of national leadership, and that's what is missing.
Do you have any safety concerns about setting up a new system or a new facility this late into the pandemic?
Well, they were used at the beginning of the process, and places like Rottnest Island could be used, as the WA Premier has said. There are other facilities that could be used. The state premiers and chief ministers are saying that they would be looking for some Commonwealth support. But what we know is there's 25,000 people stranded, not just people like the gentleman who was stranded there talking about the United States and his experience, but, you know, a young mum with a one-year-old who was told by officials in London to go find a homeless shelter to stay in with her young child.
And how much do you think the government can control this? Because even if hotel quarantine were lifted from 4,000 to 6,000, as the government suggested, technically you could get everyone home in about 5 weeks. But that's all reliant on airlines, isn't it? Is there much we can really do when we've got foreign-owned companies who are flying Aussies home?
Well, we have something, an airline called Qantas. That's the Australian National Airline that has airplanes parked in deserts. We have the Royal Australian Air Force that could be used as well in terms of particularly for regional flights. There's never been as much available aircraft capacity, and there's never been as many vacant hotel rooms in my lifetime as there are right now, and you have a Commonwealth government that is pretending that it's not in charge of borders and that it's not in charge of quarantine, but they are clearly Commonwealth responsibilities. As a result of my intervention yesterday, you had the Deputy Prime Minister go from 4,000 to 6,000, increased by 2,000 the number of arrivals that the Commonwealth said that it wanted. Maybe this interview will bump it up by another 1,000.
And on the text line, I have no sympathy for these people. Scott Morrison said at the start of the year, if you're an Australian, I urge you to come home now. Mr. Albanese, do you think Australians want to see lots of money in tight times spent on chartering flights for Aussies overseas?
Well, the Royal Australian Air Force is available. The planes are there.
It will cost us money, though, the public purse.
The planes are there. The Air Force personnel are there. If they're not being used, guess what? They actually fly around quite often in terms of training, and because the pilots have to get their hours up, they fly around quite often vacant. So there are a range of measures that can be done, and no one's suggesting that it should be completely free of charge, but the sort of idea as well, the figures that were in your story, of $110,000 for a family of five to return home to Australia is quite frankly absurd. And what we need to do is to acknowledge as well that a range of people were caught in circumstances which were not of their own making. They were people who were due to have children.
I'm just going to read one of those actually from
people who just had children.
I'm going to read one of them from the text line. Daisy says, my dad is stuck in the UK. He works overseas and wouldn't qualify for JobKeeper, so we had to choose between staying in the UK in March and coming home and not having any income at all. Now, Mr. Albanese, I'm just going to ask you a question on another topic. This week, the government announced a new strategy to increase the production and supply of gas, opening new gas fields, pipelines, and possibly even a new gas power station. Is Labor supportive of this plan?
Well, this is their 20th plan. They'll have another one in a month or two. This is the same location where the government has been saying for years, that Liddell should be kept open as a coal-fired power plant. The fact is that what is lacking from this government is a comprehensive energy policy, one that allows the market to operate. And the market tells us that the cheapest form of new energy is renewables. And what we have here is not just climate sceptics in the government, but market sceptics as well. We'll wait and see. Most of this was all, if this happens and if this doesn't happen, then something might happen down the track. This really was an announcement in search of substance.
Now, Mr. Albanese, I don't know if you're a fan of Batuta Advocate. I'm going to read you one of the headlines.
I am occasionally, although it's a worry because it could be anything.
I know, and they do like to report on you. I'm going to read you a headline from one of their stories yesterday. Albo, this is when you say more gas power plants is a bad idea, says bushfire ravaged nation. What's your response to that?
Well, I was very active during the bushfire crisis. There's no doubt that we need to act on climate change. And there's no doubt that the future is about us moving to zero net emissions by 2050, which is a policy that we have announced.
And talking about that policy just there, is it true that there are no 2030 targets in Labor's climate change policy at the moment?
No, because we haven't released a climate change policy. What we have is a draft platform that establishes principles, and that has the 2050 zero net emissions target in it. What we'll do is, as I've said consistently,
In the 2018 election, I recall Bill Shorten pledged to reduce emissions by 45% on the 2005 levels by 2030. Is that still a policy position of Labor?
You're wrong, actually. He said that at the 2019 election and at the 2016 election, because that was a policy based upon 2015. That was a 15-year target.
And is it still a position of the party?
You can't go back in. We don't have a TARDIS. We can't go back to 2015 and have a 15-year target for 2030 by definition.
All right. Mr. Albanese, thank you very much for your time on Hack today.
Thanks very much.
All Bye-bye. The best.
Hack. Get more gas, more often, and more reliable by resetting our East Coast gas market, unlocking additional gas to drive recovery
on Triple J.
Well, there's an unlikely new player in the government's energy strategy. One of Australia's youngest billionaires, tech entrepreneur Mike Cannon-Brookes, the Atlassian co-founder, has said he's interested in making a bid to replace a coal-fired power station due to shut down in a few years. He's also pretty sceptical about all this investment in the gas sector and would like to see it invested in renewables. Mike Cannon-Brookes joins me now. Thank you so much for coming on Hack today.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be back on my favourite radio station.
Oh, we love that. Now, I read that you have described yourself as an energy nerd. Does that still stand?
That's probably a pretty good description. Yeah, it's one of the hats I wear.
And how do you become an energy nerd?
I think I'm just incredibly passionate about our opportunity in energy and to have the lowest energy prices potentially in the world, in Australia. And have got more and more interested in it over the last 5 years, obviously very scientifically and technologically and economically minded, and it actually fits all of that fascinating transition we have going on.
And yesterday we had a pretty major announcement from the government around gas, and you were pretty busy on Twitter the whole day. I'm just going to read one of your tweets to our audience, and excuse me, I am paraphrasing some of the Twitter speak.
Sure.
Australia's energy market operator says gas generation not needed. CSIRO says it's expensive electricity. Economists say gas extraction creates very few jobs. Scientists says gas is incompatible with our Paris climate goals. Investors, gas equals bad returns. Meanwhile, politicians ignore expert advice and invest in more gas. Now, I think I can probably guess from that what you thought of the announcement, but what did you make of the government strategy yesterday?
Look, obviously, I'm not a very big fan of the announcement. I don't think it makes any sense. It just lines all the wrong people's pockets and won't actually do any good for the purported goals. And I think all of the experts broadly agree that that is the case. That's why I sort of listed them down there to say, look, these are the experts that I listen to about whether this is a good idea or a bad idea.
And you've kind of inserted yourself into this energy debate now. The government had said that they want the private sector to step up and fill the gap in dispatchable power when an old coal-fired power station shuts down. And they said if no one does that, they'll step up and build a gas-fired plant. And you said you might be interested in putting forward some plans.
Sure. Look, they actually said they're technology agnostic, but then said if the industry doesn't build a gas plant, they'll go build one. Now, private capital is A, going to get scared off by that, so that plant just got more expensive. And secondly, there's a reason why that is not being built. So what I was proposing is if the government is willing to put subsidies into that or invest taxpayer money for some sort of return, tell us what that is and tell us what the outcome you're trying to achieve is. And then see if there are other solutions. Let the market bid for it. We have an energy market. This is government intervention in our energy market, which will drive prices up. But if they ask for an outcome, there's a good chance they might get a cheaper, and I would argue environmentally better outcome as well for us all for the long term.
And personally, do you have a view on which sort of energy source you would like to see filling that gap?
I think there are a lot of ways that we can be smart around the firming of renewables and getting more renewables into the grid to fill most of that gap. Certainly if they're talking by the end of 2023, that's almost 3.5 years. That's a long time in energy if you look at the costs coming down very rapidly. I believe there are many, many other solutions. I'd also like to see their modelling because most of the gap, this is a Liddell coal-fired power station that's going off in 2023, being decommissioned. And I believe the gap and the energy market operator also believes that the gap is far smaller than the government is claiming it is that needs to be filled if there is a gap at all by that point. Mm-hmm. So it may not be needed whatsoever.
And you have also said in the past that you'd like to see Australia as a renewable energy superpower. Do you think in the current climate where we have governments investing in gas that there is a political will to do that?
Political will is a different question as to whether it's a relativistic certainty. We have more renewable assets than almost any country on the planet. We should be exporting that energy. We have a huge history of exporting energy. It just previously was in the form of molecules, coal and gas and things like this. We should be exporting it in many other forms. That should mean we have the cheapest cost of energy. Renewable energy is already the cheapest source. The good news in the announcement yesterday was the government saying they are putting funds towards new transmission infrastructure, which will bring far more renewables into the grid. That's great. Secondly, they tacitly admitted, although not explicitly, that we will have a 100% renewable future. So now we're just debating how do we get there and how fast, rather than will we get there. That's a pretty big turning point. for this government to say we're going to have a 100% renewably powered country. I would point out we already have a 100% renewably powered ACT. The Parliament House is powered by 100% renewables today. So we should all be very proud of that, and we should keep that going. And that will also give us the cheapest cost of energy for households, for businesses, for manufacturers, for everybody.
And in your mind, what are the sticking points moving forward in getting to that 100% renewable energy target?
Look, I would point to IEMO, so the Energy Market Operator, puts out an integrated systems plan, a very comprehensive document for the next 20 years. They list a whole series of steps that need to be taken, but do conclude that the lowest cost pathway, the pathway to the cheapest energy, is to get to 100% renewables. We have a lot of work to do on transmission, which the government is doing. They also say we don't need any more gas for the lowest cost energy. If you want higher cost energy, you can add more gas. If you want the lowest cost, no new gas generation. And forget extraction and pipelines and all the other stuff on the end. That's just a whole separate red herring.
Well, Mike Cannon-Brookes, we understand you're a very busy man, so we appreciate very much for you coming on Triple J or your favourite radio station, as you say.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Hack on Triple J.
Well, on the text line, you've got some thoughts on what Mike's got to say. And I bet Mike invests a shit ton in renewables and stands to make a killing if the government mandates it, while Steve in Canberra says, wiping the floor with facts. Awesome. Give this man a floor in Parliament.
Hack.
Downloading the app is like putting on sunscreen to go out into the sun. It gives us protection as a nation.
On Triple J.
Did you download the COVID Safe app? It was a piece of tech the PM said would save us from lockdown. But 6 months after the launch, it seems to have fallen a little off the radar. Let me know on the text line if you are one of the 5 million Aussies who have downloaded it, or if you decided not to. For a while, it felt like everyone from doctors to TikTok influencers were telling us to get it. So was it all it was cracked up to be? Claudia Long takes a look.
Which is why we've released the new COVID Safe app. It will let you know quickly if someone you've had contact with has tested positive for coronavirus and will need
us. You couldn't miss the huge campaign from the government trying to get you to download the COVID Safe app. Back in March, the PM was touting it as the way to get the country to open up again.
You know, downloading the app is like putting on sunscreen to go out into the sun. It gives us protection as a nation. It protects you, it protects your family, it protects your loved ones.
And even TikTok influencers were doing ads to try and get us on board.
If we download it, we can help prevent a second wave. Here, take a look at it.
If you need a refresher, the app uses Bluetooth to look for other phones nearby that also have the app, logging when you come into contact with others. All the data is anonymised and it can only be accessed with your permission once you've tested positive. But after all the hype, we haven't heard a whole lot about the COVID Safe app lately. Since being launched, Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria and South Australia have all accessed its data as part of their contact tracing efforts. Tassie wouldn't tell us whether they'd used it, and the ACT, WA and NT haven't used it at all because they haven't been trying to track community transmission. It's been used most in Victoria, 1,811 times to be exact, but it's in New South Wales where things get interesting. Here, it's helped tracing teams identify people who hadn't been found through manual contact tracing on 14 occasions.
It's more just like an insurance policy. You know, you get it in case you're worried that something might go wrong.
Josh Taylor is a journalist with The Guardian. He's been covering the rollout of the app, and he says it hasn't been smooth sailing.
Early on, you weren't really getting any iPhones actually communicating with any other phones, whether they're Android or iPhone, if the phones were locked.
But Josh says many of those initial bugs have been sorted.
If you've got a newer phone, it won't be draining your battery. The privacy policies there are probably some of the most strict ones within the government.
Even though COVID Safe has been around for a while now, Josh says you can expect to hear more about it as places like Victoria begin to open up again.
The app is really useful when you're in those situations where you don't know everyone that you're around. So, you know, in a bar, at a pub, at a concert, things like that. And the government will probably be trying to push the app again in a couple of months.
Some privacy experts still have concerns about COVID Safe.
The basic design that centralises all the information about who has been in contact with whom into a central database, I think that's a serious privacy risk, and it didn't need to be designed that way.
Vanessa Teague is the CEO of Thinking Cybersecurity, and she says even though many of the initial tech issues with COVIDSafe have been fixed, there's still more to do.
It's designed in a way that makes human contact tracers the bottleneck of the effort. You never get notified directly if you've been potentially exposed to COVID-19. All that happens is your name ends up on a list of people that a human contact tracer has to call.
COVIDSafe isn't the only tracking tech being used right now. In New South Wales, the State Health Department is making the most of transport data. That means every time you tap on, that bit of data you leave behind can be used at some point to help track down passengers who might have been exposed to COVID, if they've registered their Opal card. But Vanessa says even when authorities use things like Opal, a tracing app does still have a role to play.
There are situations in which strangers get together, and a Bluetooth-based app certainly has the potential to be less invasive.
She just wants it to look a bit different to how we're doing things now.
I still think it's not too late for us to switch over to a decentralised design that doesn't just add to the human contact tracing load.
Hack on Triple J.
Claudia Long reporting. And on the text line, I downloaded but deleted recently as it was affecting the Bluetooth on my phone. Damien in Wollongong, you said the app infamously didn't work. I said to myself, I will download it once the app works properly. I still haven't downloaded the app, which says something. Meanwhile, Marto in Melbourne, you say, I downloaded and discovered it destroyed my phone battery life, so I don't use it anymore. Our contact tracing efforts in Australia have ramped up as the pandemic continued, and tracking down known physical contacts, like what the app was supposed to do, was always just one part of the puzzle. We're joined by Professor Dominic Dwyer, who is the Director of Pathology West at New South Wales Health and is leading one of the teams who manage the super scientific part of contact tracing. Professor, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you.
Now, sometimes there are COVID cases where it's unknown how someone contacted the disease, but scientists like yourself can sometimes figure it out by using things like genome sequencing.
Yeah, so we have a program going here at the ICPMR at Westmead Hospital where we sequence the virus from the samples that are collected from patients that are positive. And by looking at that sequence, we can compare that sequence with other sequences to see if the viruses are closely related. And if they're closely related, then it means that those people have probably acquired the virus either from each other or from some central sort of group of people.
Now, Professor, I've heard genome tracing likened to finding the fingerprint of the coronavirus strain and then kind of working backwards with some sort of detective work. Do you think that's a reasonable description?
Yeah, that's a good description. So we look really for the blueprint of the virus, the RNA or the nucleic acid of the virus, and we sequence that now. Quite easy technology to do. And the difficult part or the expert part is looking at those sequences and comparing one to another to another to another. You know, we've had hundreds and hundreds of cases or thousands of cases in New South Wales. So it is a little bit like looking for a needle in a haystack. But with some high-powered computing and some really smart people, we can sort of track these viruses as they move through the community.
And you kind of just touched on it there, but being able to link coronavirus cases or know where the cluster started, how does that help in the efforts to contain the disease?
Look, it makes a really big difference. So, for example, if you had an outbreak in a nursing home, for example, and we've had a number of those, of course, in Australia and New South Wales, and you have, for example, an outbreak in a childcare facility, and we've had a number of those. Now, we've had cases where the virus in the childcare centre is very, very similar to the virus in the nursing home. And clearly someone is going back and forward between the two and carrying infection. And so, for example, you can then get the epidemiologists or the contact tracers on the job to find out which type of people may have been going back and forward between the nursing home and the childcare centre. For example, it might be a staff member dropping off their kid at the childcare centre who also works in the nursing home. So it really becomes very important. The other thing that's where it's been really important recently is with the outbreak in Melbourne that we've all been watching from afar. Mm. We're seeing the importation of the so-called Melbourne-like viruses coming into New South Wales and causing outbreaks. So we've been able to show that some of the outbreaks in Sydney, for example, have actually originated in Melbourne.
Right. Well, Professor Dominic Dwyer, we thank you very much for your time and good luck with all the important work you and your team are doing.
It's a pleasure.
Hack on Triple J.
Still plenty of you sending in stories about stranded family members overseas. On the text line, my twin has been stuck in Canada since March and every flight has been cancelled and they won't let her get a working visa, so she is stuck with no way home and no money. Thanks for joining us on the Hack podcast and we'll catch you on the next one.